the 2018 International Dawn Chorus Programme was one of the most ambitious we have ever undertaken, featuring live birdsong from 22 different locations throughout Europe and beyond. And while it was a delight to listen to Asian koels from India and Australian magpies, from, well, Australia, what stole the show for me was a bird a little closer to home. One that is found across Europe, Asia, and Africa. The cuckoo. In 23 years of broadcasting the Dawn Chorus on radio, the cuckoo has only made an appearance on a mere handful of occasions. The most memorable of these came in 2014, thanks to a lone male in Glenbey National Park, County Donegal, which sang loudly throughout the morning despite torrential rain. It was the wettest Dawn Chorus we've ever had. It's another very wet day as I wind my way around the famous Corkscrew Hill between Ballyvaughan and Lisdoonvarna in County Clare. I'm on my way to the townland of Croke North to meet with Susan O'Donoghue.
Well, sorry about the weather, Derek. I know it's not great, but it's typical, pretty typical.
It's lovely.
Bog weather, very atmospheric.
It's falling down in sheets,
yes,
I think.
Yes, yeah. I think it's falling sideways in sheets by the looks of
it's
the wind.
It's falling upways,
yeah,
sideways,
yeah, every
downways, every ways.
Susan is one of the many dedicated volunteers who takes part in the annual Birdwatch Ireland Country Bird Survey.
We've had, I think, in total 43 species recorded in this 1 kilometre square, so very rich habitat for birds here.
And what's the dominant species here?
Oh, wren for sure, yeah, wren.
The wren?
Wren, yeah. And then the likes of robin would be probably number two, and blackbird, all your common garden bird species. And then the meadowpipits and skylarks are quite abundant as well, because it's open country here. You've got bog with a lot of rushes, and then you've also got hazel scrub at the back where you get all the warblers, and it's a very rich kind of rich site.
And I suppose the reason the wren does so well is all the stone walls.
Yeah, perfect for nesting and creeping around and getting little insects underneath and shelter. And also another bird that uses those walls is the wheat ear. They nest inside those walls here in the burn, so love to see them as well because they're a migrant.
How does the cuckoo feature?
Cuckoo features very heavily in this area. It's not doing so great in other parts of Ireland, but here in the Burren and also along across the bay there in Connemara, that holds the highest number of breeding pairs. So it's doing really well. At the most now I've seen here in the years, 7 individuals, or not only seen, maybe just heard over the hour and a half, 2 hours I come here to survey.
And you say, you know, 7 you've heard. So we know that the males are the ones that do the calling. So that's 7 males.
Well, not necessarily, because sometimes you could see a bubbling, like hear
is that
a bubbling
female.
Female.
That's a bubbling female.
Yes.
Oh, so is that what you're counting as well?
Yeah, anything.
Because I'm told, and I know from experience, that they're hard to see.
You hear them all the time in the burn. But if you want to see them, you need to go out early in the morning. I start my survey at 6.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they're kind of kicking off for the day. They're warming up. The males are fighting each other and trying to push each other out of territories. We know that they don't defend exclusive territories. Their territories overlap a lot, but they're still having these fights.
They're more home ranges, aren't they?
Yeah, home range, there you go, exactly.
Yeah.
So the females are flying by. Now, last year was really, really phenomenal for me. Now, it had been coming 5 years, and then I got to see 2 birds. So on one side of the square, I had 2 males flying beside each other, and they were calling each other. And down the other side of the square, I used my binoculars, open country so you can see far away. There were 2 cuckoos on a wall, and one of them was flying down to the nests. And you could hear a bubbling, so one of them was a female. and she was flying down to the ground, landing on the ground, and all the metapips were rising and reacting, trying to get her out. So that was excellent to see something like that.
As I understand it, what the cuckoo does is it stakes out the host nest and waits until she has left, and then sneaks in and does it very quickly, removes one egg and deposits her egg.
Yes, there you go.
So to think that they do it and there are other meadow pipits in the area and they see all this kind of stuff, that should make them very nervous indeed.
You would think that they would get very nervous and the word would spread quickly, like birds communicate about predators in the area. What I saw in the morning was probably she was scoping out the nests just for future egg laying opportunities.
Yeah. She lays a lot of eggs, doesn't she?
Yeah, she can lay usually about 8 to 10, but I know 25 is the record one individual female.
That's really hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah, very productive.
Because that's 25 individual host nests.
Yes.
And are they all the same fathers?
Well, not necessarily, because studies have shown that, well, in Japan, I know the studies have shown that there was one female anyway, she laid in a few different nests. I think it was over 10 nests, and she had 3 different fathers siring her offspring, so you just don't know. And then there's other situations. I think it depends on the quality of the habitat. So in that situation, the habitat was really condensed and there were a lot of females and males in the one area, but in maybe in different types of habitat, maybe it might just be the one parent. As we've seen in England in another study, there was a female who laid 9 eggs and there was DNA analysis done on her eggs and they were all from the same male. So it just depends on the situation. And
have you ever come across an incident here where there were 2 cuckoo eggs in one nest?
Well, see, I don't actually access the nests.
I see.
I know, you need a
special
license.
So how far
do
you go then in that case?
I'm literally just observing. I walk for 1 kilometre and I write down everything I see or hear. And then I walk for 1 kilometre and do the same thing. And do that twice a year.
Do you ever see them in flight?
Oh yeah, it's excellent to see them in flight. Quite often when I'm driving to work in the morning. Years ago, I used to mix them up with sparrowhawk all the time. But now I think I have studied them so much that I can differentiate. They've really rapid wing beats. And that's the number one thing that makes me know that it's not a hawk.
You pick it out straight away.
Yeah, for sure. They move really, really fast. A hawk doesn't go like that. And their wings are often drooped.
They don't come up above the shoulder, I'm
that's
told,
right,
when they're flying.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, sparrowhawk will obviously raise their wings a lot higher. The tail is really long on a cuckoo. And yeah, they're smaller looking, or they're just a different type of look about them.
What is it about the habitat in this part of the world that attracts the cuckoo?
I think this this area here is ideal for cuckoo because it's not really tampered with too much. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of limestone pavement mixed in with the rough grassland, and you can't really get a lot of machinery in around limestone pavement, and so that's full of meadow pipits.
Perfect habitat for the meadow pipit, the ground
nester.
Perfect,
yeah. And that's why the cuckoos are here in such high numbers.
And lots of moths, and I believe they love moths.
Yeah, they love the hairy caterpillars, moths and butterflies. So there must be really, really good caterpillar feeding areas near here in these in little patches of forest. It doesn't seem to have changed much. As part of the CBS, we have to monitor habitat changes. In the last 6 years, I haven't noticed anything much other than plants growing taller. You know, the hazel scrubs encroached a little bit in the back of the square, but it's not changing dramatically. Or
and have you ever seen a cuckoo egg in a nest of a meadow pipit?
Just in books.
Just in books.
I've seen a fledgling over not far from here, the national park, the Burren National Park, and it was huge. This thing was giant, and a little meadow pipit was flying around busily feeding it, and I felt so sorry for the little pipit. It was giant. It was like 6 times the size of the little meadow pipit.
Yeah, the meadow pipit would be very busy feeding a bird like that.
Yeah, and you know, when you look at a situation like that, you understand where the meadow pipit's Irish name comes from. Baltra na Cuaithe, the nurse of the cuckoo.
Of the cuckoo, yeah.
Which is such a descriptive. Often when you look at the Irish name, it gives you an even more colourful description of the birds or any other animal, you know, in nature, in wildlife. It's great. We can learn a lot from the Irish language.
We would know about Bonaltron the Quirca, the cuckoo's nurse, that's the name for the meadow pipit, which would be the primary host species in Ireland. Probably 80-90% of cuckoos would use meadow pipit. But there are other ones as well. Gila na Quirca is cuckoo's servant, so it's quite clearly Irish people had a very good knowledge that the meadow pipit was the one who was feeding these little cuckoo chicks. And there's also some great folklore around them. Eina Cuaca means an only child or a cuckoo's chick, which is another interesting one, you know. And then you have other, I mean, it used to be quite black and white about cuckoos. They're either good luck or bad luck, depending on how and when you hear them. Like in one case, if you heard a cuckoo before breakfast, you would be hungry for the year. That was one
for
Irish
the year.
For the year, yeah. If you heard one through your right ear, you'd have good luck all summer. But if you heard it through your left ear, the summer wouldn't be good for you. Now, I don't know how they work that out, because you can't really tell what ear you're listening through. Strangely, if you heard a cuckoo on the morning of your wedding, this was a lucky sign. But if you heard it in the graveyard, it meant it was a death in the family coming up soon. On Tory Island now, we have a situation where it was lucky, they considered it lucky to have a cuckoo's nest on your land, but in a way that's not the thing as a cuckoo's nest, as you know. But if they had a cuckoo laying its egg in a meadow pipit's nest on your land, it was considered lucky, and it was considered very bad luck to kill a cuckoo. And they also say that when the cuckoo sings on a leafless tree, sell your cow and buy corn. So it's obviously some little turning point in the year, they feel, you know. And finally, there's a curse here, which is that may you not live to see the cuckoo or corncrake again. So that's a bit harsh, I think.
Dick Coombs is a lifelong bird watcher and coordinator of Birdwatch Ireland's Country Bird Survey. Volunteers such as Susan play an essential role in gathering the information which enables him to assess the fortunes of the birds that live in the Irish countryside. It is only through such methodical survey work and data collection that we can get a true picture of just how our birds, including the cuckoo, are faring.
Well, Derek, if you just look at this distribution map I have here from the latest Bird Atlas, which was produced in 2011, you can see there's a huge bias of the greatest abundance of the cuckoos is to the west of Ireland. And we'll say, if you drew a line from, say, Skibbereen up to Rathlin Island, anywhere west of that is where you get the biggest numbers. And east of that, we see massive gaps. So there's been quite a decline and quite a big change. In fact, our distribution has changed by 26% decline in the number of places in Ireland where you get them. And put simply, it means that they're now missing from big areas of the east and south coast, Louth, Meath, Wexford, parts of the Midlands, and even parts of Cork. But strangely, they have increased in numbers in places like Connemara and Donegal. So there's a strange shift. And if you look at the situation in the UK, there's been huge declines all throughout the Midlands and south of England, but increases up in Scotland. So this is considered to be a climate change situation here. And we've seen that same kind of axis, if you like. If you drew a line from the southwest to the northeast, that increases to the north of that and declines to the south, particularly with migrants like willow warblers and house martin, these kind of species. So exactly what's going on there, we don't know, but this is only in the last 20 years we've seen these shifts. But there are a number of factors here that are at play. High intensification of farming, particularly in the Midlands and the eastern half of the country. Greater use of pesticides. The cuckoo depends so much on caterpillars. If there are less moths, that means there are going to be less caterpillars. They like the hairy caterpillars particularly.
Yeah.
So they're so dependent. So that's why they're doing very well out in the west, like in the Burren, for example. You get cuckoos all over the place and there's plenty of caterpillars for them. But unfortunately, they're not really a bird now that you see in lowland farmland areas where you see big wheat fields or barley or corn, or even where you see lots of cattle grazing, you just don't get cuckoos. It's not their habitat anymore because they haven't got the food. The other thing that's shifted a bit is their host species. In Ireland, as we said, meadow pipit is probably 80-90% of cuckoos in Ireland will use the meadow pipit. They have declined a little bit, but their range tends to have contracted as well, because they don't like those manicured landscapes either, if you like, you know, where there's not enough insects. So if they haven't got the host species, they can't produce the young. So they're kind of, you won't say they're retreating to the west, but the numbers are doing better in the west than they are in the eastern half of the country.
The cuckoo is a bird that often provokes strong emotions, thanks to the female's infamous habit of laying their eggs in other birds' nests. Although the species' reputation may precede it, surprisingly, few people actually know what the bird looks like. Cuckoos are probably larger than you expect, measuring around 84 centimetres in length from the tip of the bill to the tip of the tail. They have long wings, as befits a bird that migrates the vast distance from Europe to sub-Saharan Africa and back each year. These wings appear quite pointed at the tips, which, coupled with the species' long tail and sleek build, make it appear very like a hawk in flight. Male cuckoos all look the same, having slate-grey heads, backs and wings, and with thin, dark stripes running across their white bellies. Unusually, though, female cuckoos come in two very different colour forms, or morphs, as ornithologists call them. Some are grey and look like males, while others are a striking reddish-brown colour with dark bars across their backs and wings. In plumage, at least, they look like two completely different species. And it's only the male that makes that distinctive cuckoo call.
Yeah, our cuckoos arrive in Ireland in the second half of April. In fact, the earliest on record dates from the 1800s on the 2nd of April. So I'm certainly always a bit suspicious of any claims of cuckoos, especially in the newspaper. Is this the first? You know, if it's anything before the, say, the 10th of April, the chances are it's a collared dove. I saw one time, I said, I heard a cuckoo in the centre of Kenmare today. Is this a first? And it was way, way too early. It's clearly a collared dove, you know. The adults are only here for a very short time. Having come, say, in the second half of April, they're starting to go already in July. In July, prepares to fly is the old thing. And, you know, the adults could be all mostly gone by the first days of August. And, of course, the young ones will leave maybe about a month later. And that's the amazing thing, how they can make that journey.
And do we know how they make that journey and which journey they actually take, which way they go?
Well, for Irish ones, no. It'd be great to have the money to do it. I know there's been great work done in Cambridge and, you know, tracing where the ones in southeastern Britain are heading down in two different journeys through Europe. And some of them bypass the Sahara Desert going out west, out around West Africa. Others come east of the Sahara, but they all end up in much the same wintering ground in southern Africa, which is fascinating. No, there's no research in Ireland, unfortunately.
But do you know where the Irish ones are going to? Which part of Africa?
No, the answer is no. We can only assume it follows a very similar pattern to in Britain, but there's a much higher density of cuckoos in Britain anyway, so goodness knows, it's a
and
nice
they've got
little,
more money.
More money. It's a nice little job for somebody. It's a nice little job for somebody now. So maybe next season, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, we shall shortly be arriving at Cambridge. Cambridge is the next station stop.
Cuckoos are highly migratory. They breed in Europe during the northern summer, but then fly south to sub-Saharan Africa to spend the winter, returning to us in late spring.
Cambridge Conservation Initiative, how may I help you? I'll redirect your call now.
To find out more about their movements and to discover not just where they come from and where they go, but also the routes they take to get there, I travelled to the Cambridge Conservation Initiative. There, I spoke with Chris Hewson, a senior research ecologist with the British Trust for Ornithology and the man responsible for the revolutionary cuckoo satellite tracking project.
We've lost 3/4 of our cuckoos in the last 25 years in England. In Wales, we've lost about 1/3, and in Scotland, the population's been pretty stable. So there's regional variation, as well as the picture of a general decline. We didn't know anything when we started this project about their migration. So the 3/4 of the year that we thought they spent elsewhere, we had very little information on, apart from the fact that we thought that cuckoos migrated southeastwards from the UK to stop over in Italy before going into Africa. But we actually had very, very little information about what they did once they got there. Mm-hmm. In fact, the only piece of information we had was a single recovery of a British ringed cuckoo. It was actually a juvenile which had been ringed in a pied wagtail's nest. It's in June 1928, which was recovered in Cameroon in January 1930. So that was the only piece of information we had about what the cuckoos might do when they weren't here.
Just one recovery?
Exactly, yeah.
So that's extraordinary.
Yeah, and even that we found out subsequently didn't actually give us the information that we thought it did. Mm-hmm. The third reason is that the cuckoo is the largest of the small nocturnally migrating long-distance migrants, which means it's the first that we've been able to track using satellite tracking technology, as that technology has been miniaturised over the years. And that's got a number of advantages, in particular the fact that we can track birds in real time, which means that we can find out not just where the birds go, but also where they die. So we get information from every bird that we tag, including those that don't come back.
So you said nocturnally migrating?
Yeah, that's right. They actually migrate, as do many small tropical migrating songbirds and similar type species, almost exclusively by night. The only exception to that is actually something we discovered in the early years of this project. And that's that when the birds are migrating over the Sahara Desert, they actually continue their migrations into the day. And this was counter to expectations because people thought that songbirds would land during the day to avoid overheating and dehydrating. But in fact, we found the birds continued to migrate over the desert by day as well as by night. And actually, the temperature sensors on the devices showed us that they were doing this by rising to a height of about 3 miles, so 5,000 meters, where it's much, much cooler.
So they migrate at night because of temperature, do you think? Is that the reason for it? Is it to avoid predation, or do we have any idea what the reasons are?
I think it's probably a bit of both of those, actually. Probably outside of the Sahara Desert, maybe temperature isn't quite so significant, but nonetheless, it could well be a contributory factor. They do it in temperate regions as well as in the tropics, so I don't think temperature is the main reason, but predation could definitely be a large part of it.
Tell me a little bit about the information the tracking device is giving you.
Basically, what these devices do is they give off a constant signal, a radio signal at a very, very constant frequency, which is picked up by satellites passing overhead. And as the satellite moves in relation to the tag, the frequency changes. So it's called the Doppler effect. It's a bit like the way that an ambulance coming towards you sounds different to it going when it's going away. Mm-hmm. And the Argos satellite system is able to use this information to do some extremely clever calculations and work out to sometimes to within a kilometre, sometimes a little bit less, a little bit more, but roughly to work out to a pretty good accuracy where the bird and therefore the tag is on the ground.
So what have you discovered?
Well, we've discovered that the birds take two different routes to get to Africa, which was counter to expectations. Ringing recovery suggested, as I mentioned earlier, that the birds migrated southeastwards down to Italy before going down to Africa from there. But actually, we found that some of the birds took a second route via Spain, which was totally unexpected, because we'd only ever had, birds recovered east of their ringing location. So we'd never even had a ringing recovery which would give any hint of a westward movement at all. But then the second thing that we've discovered is that the birds actually migrating via Spain and via Italy converge, and they all end up wintering in exactly the same spot. So that's a completely unexpected pattern as well. Normally in bird migration, if birds take two different routes from the same starting point, they'll end up in different places. But we found that they didn't. They actually converged on exactly the same spot. And then thirdly, we found out that the birds that actually take these two different routes survive differently. So those which migrate via Spain actually survive a lot less well in the early part of their migration up to the completion of Sahara crossing than those that migrate via Italy. And we've been able to relate this to the population declines of the local populations from which we have tracked birds. And we found that where more birds take the less successful route via Spain, the population decline has been bigger than in those areas where more birds take the more successful route. So this suggests that this mortality on migration is actually contributing to the population decline.
Okay, and what are they doing when they get to their wintering grounds?
They stay in, sort of secondary edges of tropical rainforest and in secondary tropical rainforest in particular. We know that a lot of our birds are wintering actually in the Congo Basin itself, including some in closed canopy rainforest. We've got some of the birds are wintering in some of the wettest forests that are there in the Congo. And in fact, one guy called Hugo Rainey sent me some photographs of one of the patches that one of our cuckoos was wintering in. He'd worked there for the WWF, and he said it had some of the highest densities of western lowland gorillas anywhere in the world. So certainly for me, it was a bit of an eye-opener to think that the cuckoos that we hear around here in the summer go off and spend Christmas with gorillas in the Congo Basin.
And the reason why they're not making it, if they take one route over another?
We don't know for sure. We think that climate change in Spain may be contributing. It's getting much, much drier there. And in years when the wildfires and droughts have been particularly bad, no birds at all that have taken that route have made it. So that's definitely looking like it's part of the picture. However, we also know that those birds actually leave the UK 10 days later than birds which take the route via Italy. Mm. But they reach they complete the Sahara crossing at the same time. So it's likely that they have to do some extra pre-migratory fattening here in the UK. And we know that those birds taking the southwestern route are only found in those areas of England where the moth declines, the caterpillars of which are the key food for adult cuckoos, have been the greatest. So it's quite possible that actually these birds are being disadvantaged by changes here in England before they migrate, and this has also left them more vulnerable to what's going on in Spain. So we're doing more work at the moment to try and work out what is the contribution of conditions in the UK versus conditions in southern Europe in determining the survival of these two groups of cuckoos.
And what do you know about our Irish cuckoos?
We don't actually know very much at the moment, actually, and it would be really interesting to track them from Ireland. If you look at habitat type, And possibly the history of, you know, the invasions, etc. You might expect them to be Northern European birds, certainly in a lot of the areas which would migrate southeast. But it's entirely possible also that there are some of these southwestwards migrating birds there as well. We know that, for instance, in Dartmoor, we have a mixture of the two. Mm-hmm. So it's not entirely possible. Although in Wales so far, all the birds we've tracked have taken the southeasterly route, I wouldn't rule out the idea that in Southern Ireland there could be some of these birds migrating in a southwesterly direction. Who knows?
For centuries, the song of the cuckoo formed the backdrop to life right across rural Ireland. And though it remains a reasonably common feature in some parts of the country, it is now heard by fewer people than ever before.
Derek, is that a cuckoo?
I received that message to my mobile phone from my friend John Seary. John is based in Dublin, but his family live in Coolvuck in County Westmeath.
Hi, Derek. Welcome to Athlone.
Thank you very much indeed.
I don't feel like I'm in Athlone. I'm on the fringes of Athlone.
Well, it's the middle of Ireland, and you're definitely in the middle of the middle of Ireland. So, yeah. This is my parents, Roger and Marie.
Yeah, well, I take it you're Marie. Hello, Marie.
That's right.
And
nice
Roger. Nice to meet you. And this is your brother?
Brother Frank, yes.
Frank, you've got the book in your hand.
Yeah.
So you must know all that needs to be known about the birds in the area.
Yeah.
Now, John, you sent me the recording, so yeah. Why?
I know this is a terrible thing to say, but I never heard a cuckoo in Ireland before. That was the first time I heard it, and for a second I thought I was still asleep. But it was that loud one morning that I got out of bed and I opened the windows, and there was cuckooing away for at least 5-10 minutes.
How long did you live in this house for?
I'd say on and off. I mean, my parents are here now 20 years, but I lived here fully for 2-3 years. And even in that time, I didn't hear a cuckoo. Never heard a cuckoo. And this year, it was just went on and on and on. I seriously thought it was hallucinating. and that's why I got in touch, because I've never heard a cuckoo. I didn't even know they even existed in Ireland, which is terrible. But I just sent it to you because I thought, you know what? It's something different. You don't hear them every day, at least in my case. And just in case you knew anything about it, why I would have heard it in Athlone, of all places.
Mm. A good rule of thumb is that if you hear a bird calling and you have to ask yourself if it is a cuckoo or not, then it most probably isn't. The rhythmic coos of wood pigeons and collared doves might dupe the unwary listener at first, but once you hear the real thing, you instantly and instinctively know what it is. As I've mentioned, it's only the male cuckoo that utters the famous cuckoo song that gives the species its name. In Europe, at least, most male birds learn what song to sing by listening to their fathers while they are very young. It doesn't come naturally to them. Cuckoos are different. After all, they've never even met their fathers. Their songs are genetically hardwired into their brains. As it happens, the Midlands are an important stronghold for cuckoos in Ireland, and their song is a common one. You just need to know when to listen for it, as John's father Roger explains.
6:30 to 7 o'clock, that's when it's mostly in the morning now.
Tell me, do you think you have one cuckoo or two cuckoos or three cuckoos?
I think it's a family of cuckoos. Mm. Because when I go to an old farm, right, I hear them as well. So, you know, and I go to another farm, I see hear them as well. So, here before.
How many farms have you got?
Well, no, just a few. No, don't mind that. Just out farms, you know what I mean? So, you still hear the cuckoo, different cuckoos.
Yeah.
So, I never heard so many as this year. And the first time I heard a cuckoo was on the 24th of April, not very early.
Well, no, they come around the middle of April.
Do they?
Now, there's some records dating back, some saying that they came around the 2nd of April.
All right.
That was a famous documented case.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of April Fool's cuckoos as well, back in the day when the newspapers, and I'm sure the newspapers still do, we certainly do it on radio. We'll always report the first swallow of the first cuckoo if people contact us on the radio programme.
Yeah.
But people used to call in and say, oh, I heard my first cuckoo. And sometimes it gets printed in the newspapers and then everybody realises, hang on, that was the 1st of April.
Oh, yeah.
And it might have been some young fella down off in the field making the sound of a cuckoo.
Yeah.
But around the middle of April, traditionally, is when they come here.
And I never heard them early this year now. I thought it was early. No. Maybe it could have been earlier than that even.
And you think you're hearing a lot more this year?
Oh, a lot more, yeah. I never heard so many this year now. And it seemed to be petal, as the fella says. I guess sound awesome so this year for some reason. This one now, is it?
Yeah. That is one, actually.
That's it.
Now.
But what does the sound mean to you?
It brings you back to childhood as well. You hear the cuckoo, you know. So, and it's traditional, like every year you hear. When you hear the cuckoo, that means the summer and the spring is, you know, there. Apart from that, it's great, isn't it?
I take it you're all very happy to hear the cuckoo on your land.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a good sign, isn't it?
It's a very good sign. It's great. Yeah. It's a great indicator that everything is doing well, because for the cuckoo to do well, the host species has to be doing well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a great sign. And it's a lovely sound. And I'm glad to see they're thriving here in Coolvuck.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know the origin of the name Coolvuck?
Pig's back, isn't it?
The pig's back. Hill, yeah, pig's or back. Something like that.
It's supposed to be good luck.
Good luck.
Well, it's good luck for the cuckoo anyway.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Song is crucial in the avian world. Most female birds listen to their fathers to learn what song they should listen out for when seeking a potential mate when they reach adulthood. Female cuckoos, however, innately know the sound of a male and are intrinsically drawn to it. They themselves don't cuckoo, but rather utter a bizarre, bubbling, chuckling noise, especially when laying their eggs. Recent studies have revealed that while potential host birds such as reed warblers and meadow pipits completely ignore the song of the male cuckoo, they simply don't register it as a threat, they react sharply to the sound made by a female. It appears that this call commands their attention so effectively that it makes them less likely to notice that a foreign egg has appeared in their nest.
The cuckoo is very much a generalist. It will parasitise birds in woodland, for example, robins and dunnocks. But it also, as you say, it occupies open country, going for meadow pipits in Ireland and Scotland and Wales, and reed warblers in Fenland here. And there's little bits of geographical variation in the cuckoo noises, and there is some suggestion that actually the cuckoo does have more lower pitched and narrower band frequencies in woodland, which is what you'd expect for acoustic adaptation. But overall, cuckoos just go cuckoo everywhere. But it's only the male that goes cuckoo. The female has this extraordinary bubbling cry, which still sends shivers down my spine, because of course it's a sign that there's a cheat at large on the fen.
The whole egg-laying process has long captivated Nick Davies, Professor of Behaviour Ecology at the University of Cambridge and author of the acclaimed book Cuckoo, Cheating by Nature.
So sometimes when the light's very bright, it's sometimes difficult to see.
Look at that. Oh, wow.
Wow, look at that.
That is just beautiful, Nick.
So,
absolutely.
So what we have here is a little reed warbler nest. It's not much bigger than a tennis ball. And it's a beautiful cup, a little basket, suspended between three reed stems. It's about a metre above the water surface. And inside this, practically filling the cup, we have a cuckoo chick.
My God.
Isn't it amazing?
Isn't he huge? He's going to burst out of it very soon. And he's by no means much grown, is he?
No, he's about 8 days old, and he's still got another week at least in the nest.
Dr. Richard Collins met up with Nick Davies at Wicken Fen, one of Britain's oldest nature reserves. The fen is home to a thriving population of reed warblers, a small brown migratory bird that is just a scarce and localised breeder in Ireland, but which is much more common and widespread in Britain and across the continent. At Wicken Fen, as well as throughout much of its range, the reed warbler is the cuckoo's preferred host.
Now, if I just nudge the reeds a little with this stick, look, he's opening his orange gape, a blaze of orange, and he's already got a little defensive display where he rears up and jerks at you. And this must be a very effective deterrent against predators. But isn't that just amazing?
Isn't that something? Isn't it extraordinary? That is a most extraordinary sight.
He looks quite reptilian because his feathers are still in quill. And in a week's time, he'll completely overflow the nest, and the nest gets flattened into a little platform, so you just see cuckoo.
Oh, my God. That is an absolutely beautiful sight.
Now, this is just about the busiest part of the fen. So there are hundreds of children coming past every day to go pond dipping. The wardens are busy with tractors and all the mechanical work on the fen. And yet the cuckoo has managed to slip in and lay her egg completely undetected. And if you'll notice, there's a big willow tree just behind us, and I suspect she just sat very quietly there, watching the reed warblers build their nest, and was able to time the laying of her egg, just get it right.
And the little reed warblers are probably watching us now, waiting, They come back and waste all their energy raising this chick of their enemy. Isn't it dreadful?
It's amazing. These reed warblers have come all the way from Africa to breed on Wickham Fen, and they've spent the whole summer raising a chick of the wrong species, and they'll go back to Africa having made no genetic profit whatsoever.
Isn't nature cruel? How on earth could you possibly have found that?
Well, I find nests just by using this stick and parting the reeds and going along. And sometimes you can tell where a nest is going to be because there's a male reed warbler singing in a little stretch there. So you know to look out.
So you check all the nests you can find for cuckoo's eggs. You don't go looking around for cuckoos and saying it's likely to be one here and watch the cuckoo until such time you see her laying.
No, we do what's called cold searching. We go along the ditches systematically with our sticks, and every nest we find we plot and we record whether it's got a cuckoo egg or no cuckoo egg. And in fact, this season we found about 200 reed warblers' nests, and we've had just 8 with a cuckoo egg. So we're very lucky today to see one. They're getting rare now.
That's depressing, all right, isn't it? So you will then monitor the nest throughout its entire life.
We do,
hatching, to fledging, so on and so forth.
We do, yes.
And measure the amount of food being brought in, watching the number of visits and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, exactly that. Mm. So when you see a site like this, this is what thrills me about cuckoos and their hosts. It really raises the question, how on earth does the cuckoo get away with it? Or in other words, why are the hosts being so stupid as to feed this enormous cuckoo chick rather than be sure that they raise a brood of their own? And it's that evolutionary battle between hosts and cuckoos that I've been trying to unravel by simple experiments during the last 2 decades or so.
An arms race between the two of them.
Exactly, an evolutionary battle or arms race.
And neither is winning.
Well, we can talk about that later on. Okay. I've got more to show you.
Wonderful.
So I'm just going to close the reeds up now and we'll go away and let the reed warblers carry on feeding this monster. Mm.
Famously, cuckoos build no nests of their own. Having mated with a male, a process which takes just a couple of seconds, each female selects the nests of unwitting host birds in which to lay her eggs. Foster parents, which are invariably far smaller than she is. A female cuckoo almost always lays her eggs in the nests of the same species of bird which originally raised her when she was a chick. In many cases where the same host species has been exploited for generations, evolution will have led her to produce eggs which resemble those of her victims, in colour at least, if not in size. If she were to lay in the nest of a different species with differently coloured eggs, she could be rumbled.
In my bag here I've brought a reed warbler nest with some eggs in from our museum. It's the end of the season now, so all the cuckoos we've got are chicks, but I wanted to show you a cuckoo egg. So let me describe the nest first. So this is an absolute miracle of animal architecture. So it's built solely by the female. She collects the old reed heads and she weaves between 3 or 4 reed stems this little basket, this little sunken basket. And she anchors it to the reed stems using spider silk. So one of the most magical things you can see in the morning in the fens is the female reed warblers collecting this spider silk from the top of the reeds. And inside this nest here, we've got 4 eggs. They're all green and spotted. Now, would you like to guess, Richard, which is the cuckoo egg?
Well, one of them, they look like tiny blackbird's eggs. We have no, well, we have some reed warblers now in Ireland and along the south coast.
Right.
But people in Ireland would not be too familiar with reed warblers. Sedge warblers, yes, but not reed warblers. They look like tiny blackbird's eggs, I think. But one is a little bigger than the other.
Right.
It's a more substantial egg.
That's right.
And so, I think the cuckoo's a biggie. He's a very big bird to be producing such tiny eggs.
So this is amazing. So isn't the match fantastic? Every spot has almost been copied to perfection and the background colour is absolutely right too, this sort of pale greeny olive colour. But you're right, it's a little bit bigger.
Now, is that egg slightly incubated before she deposits it? I mean, she has to get it to come out first.
She does. So let's go back a little bit to how the cuckoo lays her eggs. So this stretch we're on at the moment is perfect cuckoo habitat. We've got a waterway lined by reeds where the reed warblers nest, and each pair of reed warblers will occupy a little stretch, maybe 20 metres or so as a territory. And behind us here we've got some trees, buckthorns and willows and ash trees. And it's from these treetops that the female cuckoo, who also defends the territory, will watch her host build. And a typical territory here for female cuckoo would contain maybe 20 to 30 pairs of reed warbler nests. Now, I thought I was a good bird watcher, and I know you're a good bird watcher too, Richard, but neither of us are in the same league as a female cuckoo. She is extraordinary. So she monitors the progress of these 20 to 30 reed warblers' nests very precisely. She's only going to lay one egg in each nest. She's only here for 2 or 3 months, so what she needs is staggered laying in these hosts to provide opportunities throughout the season. She's going to lay perhaps 20 or more eggs in the season if she's lucky. If she comes across a reed warbler nest where incubation is already underway, so it's too late to parasitise that nest, she'll swallow the whole clutch. That pair will then start a replacement nest which she can parasitise. So by systematically farming host nests in this way through the season, she makes staggered opportunities for parasitism available. Now, she times her laying in each host nest very precisely. She waits until the reed warblers have started their clutch. So reed warblers typically lay one egg a day, a clutch of 4 eggs. She waits until at least one egg is in the nest, but she could lay on day 2, 3, or 4. And then one afternoon, she glides down from the tree. She picks out one of the reed warbler's eggs. She sits briefly in the nest to lay her own, and then she's off. And what's astonishing is that that whole process takes less than 10 seconds. It's so quick you can't believe she could possibly have laid, but you go up to the nest and sure enough, one egg has gone, the reed warbler's egg, and it's been replaced by this identical cuckoo egg. So when the reed warblers come back to the nest, nothing seems amiss, same number of eggs in the nest. There's now, however, a cuckoo egg in the nest. Now, the reed warblers, if they get fooled by this cuckoo egg, are in trouble. They're literally sitting on a bomb set to explode in 11 days' time, one which is going to destroy their clutch, because the cuckoo chick will hatch out first, and then, just a few hours old and still naked and blind, it balances each of the reed warbler's eggs on its back one by one, clambers up to the edge of the nest, and with a little flick of its wing stumps, tosses them overboard. If there's any reed warbler chicks that happen to be hatched out, they get exactly the same treatment, and they drown in the water below. And what's truly astonishing is that sometimes the reed warbler parents are there watching the destruction of their own chances of reproduction, and yet they do nothing to interfere. Now, Richard, you asked, how does a cuckoo egg hatch first? And you're right, the female cuckoo lays every other day. This was discovered by Edgar Chance in the 1920s through a brilliant bit of bird watching. I mean, he was an egg collector, but he worked out that in order to collect as many cuckoo eggs as possible, he had to work out how the female cuckoo lays her egg so he could be there to snaffle it before other egg collectors did. And he discovered that female cuckoos lay in the afternoon and they lay every other day. And this laying every other day is part of the cuckoo's secret trickery because it means that each egg has 24 hours incubation inside the female's oviduct before it's laid. So it's got a head start in development. And that head start in development enables the cuckoo chick to hatch out first and so throw out the reed warbler's eggs, presumably because eggs are easier to toss out than chicks.
Well, now, a marvellous feat of data processing. you described there now cuckoo, female cuckoos sitting in the bushes here for days on end, noting what's going on.
Yes.
And predicting in some way that that nest is going to be viable on Thursday and the one over there would be Monday.
Yes.
And now, are they using some visual cue on the day to do that, or have they sort of noted something and then started a clock, an individual clock, in fact, a clock for every one of the blooming ones they're looking at, maybe 20 clocks running? How do they do this? Have we any idea?
No, those are all wonderful questions and we don't know. So we know they do it, but we don't know how they do it. So there's a little bit of evidence from Edgar Chance's study. He studied metapipits on a common in the 1920s to show that cuckoos do have plans. They plan ahead. So they would sit for 2 or 3 hours on a tree and before they lay in a targeted nest. Sometimes they'll glide down and that nest has been predated, so is no longer possible as a target. They'll then go to another nest as a backup and lay an egg there. So that suggests they've got some sort of backup plans if things go wrong. If they fail to find a suitable nest of their favourite host that day, they'll just go and lay in any bird's nest. So they can't hold that egg forever. They just get rid of it.
But these second egg nests, are they ones that are at the appropriate stage of laying, or is it just anything will do now and it doesn't matter, it might survive?
Any port in a storm sort of thing.
Yes, well, I think they would hope to get another viable nest to parasitise, but in cases where females lose the opportunities to parasitise their favourite nest that day, they'll just lay anywhere, and that egg's probably not going to succeed.
And when they remove the egg to replace it with their egg, yes, is that a random selection, or do we know?
We do know. So a cuckoo removes an egg at random. So in the old days, we had many more cuckoos on Wick and Fen. Now it's only about 2 or 3% of the reed warbler's nests get parasitised. But in the 1980s, when we began our study, it was 10 or 20%. Just cuckoos were more abundant in the old days. And when cuckoos were abundant, occasionally we found two cuckoo eggs in the same nest.
Mm.
So probably there's a territorial female and there's a sneaky roaming female who sometimes lays her egg in the same nest. Now, what a cuckoo should do, of course, is if it comes to a nest where there's already a cuckoo egg, it should remove that cuckoo egg because it's going to hatch first and would throw out her egg. But amazingly, this is a flaw in the cuckoo's behaviour. They don't target other cuckoos' eggs. They just remove an egg at random. So sometimes by chance, if there are lots of cuckoos about, you will get two cuckoo eggs in the same nest. Now, why female cuckoos don't target previous cuckoos' eggs, I don't know. They should do, but they don't. But if both cuckoo eggs remain, then what happens is if they both hatch out, you get a tremendous battle. And it's usually the prior hatching, the bigger chick, which will throw the other chick out. But sometimes this battle can go on for a day or two before one cuckoo chick will command the nest.
No thought or emotion goes into any of this. The cuckoos are simply doing what millions of years of evolution have led them to do. Indeed, what their nature compels them to do. They are as much hostages to their genes as their hosts are. Why does the female cuckoo only remove one egg from a host nest? If she ate them all, surely she would obtain even more nutrients and would also presumably make life easier for her chick when it hatches.
What my colleagues and I have tried to do is to try and work out why do the cuckoos behave in this way. And the way we've done that is we've become cuckoos ourselves and we've popped model cuckoo eggs into reed warblers' nests to see how they behave.
To answer these questions, Professor Davies has conducted a series of fascinating experiments using artificial cuckoo eggs.
So these model eggs are made from a mould of a real cuckoo egg, so they're exactly the same size and weight. They're made of resin, in fact, and I've painted them with acrylic paints to represent a range of colours.
This is your own work.
It's actually quite nice sitting in the evening listening to Mozart and making your own cuckoo eggs. But it's hard work being a cuckoo because you've got to wander around finding all these reed warbler nests. Now, what we discovered is that if you put in a model egg that matches the reed warbler's eggs, which is, of course, what real cuckoos do, in other words, a green spotted egg, the reed warblers will usually accept it. But if you put in a model egg which is of a different colour, for example, white or blue or brown, the reed warblers are much more likely to throw it out. So that very simple experiment shows that the cuckoo's matching egg is important for fooling the hosts. Now, you're right, you notice the cuckoo's egg was a bit bigger than the reed warbler's eggs, but it's still a very small egg for a bird the size of a cuckoo. I mean, cuckoos are huge compared to reed warblers. And in fact, this is the size of egg that you'd expect a cuckoo to lay if it was a normal nesting bird. And this egg is about the size of that of a missile thrush. So what we did is we painted these eggs, again to match the reed warbler eggs in colour, but we found the reed warblers were much more likely to reject a giant egg than a cuckoo-sized egg. So again, that simple experiment shows that the cuckoo's egg has got to match well in colour and also reasonably in size, although it can get away with an egg that's slightly bigger than the reed warbler's eggs. Now, you asked the question, why does the cuckoo remove an egg? And we agreed with you. We thought the reason must be that the host count and will notice an extra egg in the nest. But to our surprise, we found that as long as the match was good in colour, the reed warblers would accept our model eggs, even if we just added them to the clutch. So the hosts aren't counting to look out for an extra egg. And that suggests there must be another reason for why the cuckoo removes a host egg. And we think there are two reasons. One is that it ensures that the incubation limit isn't exceeded. If she added her egg to the clutch, I think there'd be a reduced chance that her own egg would hatch, just because there'd be too many eggs in the nest for the reed warblers to keep warm. There's another advantage too, and you mentioned this, and that is that cuckoo swallows the egg, so she gets a free meal while she's on the job.
And helps her form the next egg.
Which might, exactly. Now that raises the question, of course, why doesn't the female cuckoo remove all the reed warbler's eggs so she gets even more nourishment? And again, our experiments provide the answer. And the answer is that the reed warblers will always desert a single egg. So there's a limit to the number of eggs that the cuckoo can remove. Usually one is the most she can safely remove. But the neat thing is that the cuckoo chick can then throw all the eggs out of the nest, because although the reed warblers will always desert a single egg, they never desert a single chick. So that's why it's the cuckoo chick that has to do the ejecting, not the female cuckoo earlier on at the egg stage.
Hopefully, the day will come when to be called a cuckoo will no longer be seen as an insult. Love them or hate them, there is no denying that cuckoos are very special birds indeed. Their behaviour and life cycle is utterly unlike that of any other Irish or European bird. And their song has long been celebrated as the sound of summer itself. Susan O'Donoghue.
Now, Derek, before you go, I'd wanted to play a little bit of Claire Constantina here. There's a cuckoo hornpipe tune, very, very famous tune played around these parts by a man called Chris Droney. He's from Bell Harbour, just down the road here. He's 94 years old and still going strong. And he's an excellent concertina player. But what I love about this tune is the second part of the hornpipe, you can hear him playing cuckoo, cuckoo with his concertina.
Now, do I need a musical ear or will it be very obvious?
I mean, anyone can. I think I say that anyone can hear the cuckoo. I hope. You tell me, maybe.
This isn't your ringtone, is it?
No, it's not my ringtone, no.
But you have it on your phone. You've recorded it on your phone.
I recorded it just to listen to, because I love Irish music, love traditional Irish music.
What's his name again?
Chris Droney. He's such a character. He's gas. I got to know him. Well, I've known him to see since I was a young child, but I only got to know him a little bit better in the last few years by doing research on his land. There was a pair of nesting ravens in a castle just close to his land, so great crack going through the fields, and he brought me in for tea many times. Him and his wife are gorgeous people. So would you like to hear it?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Great. Okay, here we go. Listen for the cuckoo. It's coming up now.
Fantastic. I can hear it really clearly there. Beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, really, really clear. Once you tune your ear in, it's really easy to hear it.
Changes to our landscape and our climate have made it harder for the cuckoo to survive. Its fortunes are inextricably linked to those of the host birds, without which it cannot reproduce. They are also linked to the caterpillars that form such a vital food source for them. As the numbers of large moths decline due to pesticides, hedgerow destruction, and agricultural intensification, so too do our cuckoos. Let's hope that the habitats upon which the cuckoo, its hosts and its prey depend can be preserved and restored, and that its magical song will remain to delight people across Ireland for many more generations to come. ¶¶